Great. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're ready for the third matter on our calendar today. Today's date is July 22nd, 2020. So if the marshal will call the third case, please.
The Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfold, Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Judge Diane B. Bratfold presiding, and case number A20-0266, Lawrence Leneau et al. Appellants. First, Jeff Huber et al. Respondents.
All right, and I'll make just a few remarks before we go ahead with the argument. We are, of course, having this argument today via WebEx, and so I will just remind counsel in the case to hopefully do what you'll see us doing, which is to turn on your mute button to mute your microphone during the time that you are not speaking. And we do that just to improve sound quality. It seems to make a difference, and so we continue to do it. We will, of course, unmute ourselves when we're ready to ask a question. And you should do likewise when it's your time to make a presentation. Before you begin your remarks, if you would identify yourself for the record, as well as the client that you represent. And then please keep an eye on the clock. You can see that the marshal has positioned a timing device so that it's visible, and you'll see the 15 minutes counting down. You each have 15 minutes for your primary remarks, and then the appellant, if you choose, has 5 minutes for rebuttal. So with that, I think we're ready for counsel for appellant. Please begin when you are ready.
Thank you very much, Judge. Mark Anthonson, appearing on behalf of the appellants today. This is my first appellate argument by WebEx. I've done a few in district court, so I apologize in advance if I don't properly follow your rules of decorum as well as I should. I'll do my best. This case arises under the Minnesota Open Meeting Law, and the principal issue on the appeal is whether the trial court abused its discretion when it awarded more than $66,000 in sanctions against the appellants, stating that their open meeting law claims were frivolous and malicious. Now, in pursuing the appeal, I recognize that the abuse of discretion standard is not especially favorable to appellants generally, and that it accords considerable deference to the trial court. But at the same time, the standard does impose some boundaries, and in particular, when exercising its discretion, the trial court must properly apply the governing law. This court's precedents make very clear that if an award of sanctions is based on an erroneous view of the law, then an abuse of discretion occurs. Now, in this case, for the trial court to have properly found that my client's claims were frivolous and without merit, which is the standard found in the open meeting law for awarding sanctions in favor of defendants, the trial court needed to establish that it was perfectly apparent without argument that their claims lacked an objective good faith basis in law or in fact. That is the standard described in the Supreme Court's Wallace versus State decision, as I describe in my brief.
Mr. Anthonson, you perhaps started to answer my question. Counsel for respondent argues in the brief that the word ambiguous is frivolous is not ambiguous. And so I'm assuming, do you call it ambiguous, but without legal precedent? Do we use the dictionary or the Wallace decision? And what, and I know you cited a couple other cases I recall as well, but is the phrase ambiguous?
Your Honor, I actually don't think it is particularly ambiguous. And I think it's one of those legal terms that even pages upon pages upon pages of definitioning doesn't necessarily make precise. I think most people, certainly lawyers and judges, have a basic sense of what's frivolous and what's not. But I do think the discussion in Wallace, which is quite extensive, does help illuminate the sort of reference points that we should be looking at in deciding what the legislature meant in the open meeting law. So to continue, so again, according to the definition that Wallace describes, the cause of action must lack an objective good faith basis in both law or fact. However, in this case, based on the undisputed record in the trial court, exactly the opposite is true. There is a good faith basis in law and a clearly good faith basis in fact for my client's claims. First of all, both of my client's open meeting law claims were clearly valid as a matter of law. Since a quorum of a government body cannot discuss public business privately, that's settled law, and both of the claims made under the open meeting law basically are posited on that claim, that there was private discussions of public business. And it doesn't appear that the trial court even contests that. So I think that's straightforward. Instead, in holding that my client's open meeting law claims were frivolous and malicious, Judge McBride in the trial court based his decision solely on the conclusion that the appellants had not provided any evidence of a violation. And that gets us to the crux of my argument on appeal. There were two claims with respect to the claim that the city council and Grant had abused its consent agenda by pre-deciding and deliberating about agenda items prior to public meetings. Judge McBride stated this: plaintiffs have not provided the court with any evidence to go along with their presumptions, assumptions, inferences, and conjectures. There is absolutely no evidence before the court to support plaintiff's claim. And then on the second count, the one regarding the Planning Commission of the City of Grant, Judge McBride stated as follows: Leno, which is one of the two plaintiffs, admitted that in fact he never heard a word of what was spoken by any of the Planning Commission members during this alleged open meeting violation. According to Judge McBride, Mr. Leno's admission that he did not hear any of their conversation is fatal to his claim. And so when you read Judge McBride's analysis of these two claims, what that analysis boils down to is that because appellants had no direct evidence of the alleged violations, in other words, they had no admissions, no concessions, no acknowledgement from any of the defendants that they did violate the open meeting law, the appellant's open meeting law claims were frivolous and malicious. No direct evidence, frivolous and malicious.
Counsel, I think you're inserting the word direct now. I don't know that the district court said no direct evidence, but be that as it may, and I understand that lots of times there might be circumstantial evidence of an open meeting law violation. Can you speak to me about whether direct or circumstantial, what was the evidence of violations of the open meeting law around the consent decree? Excuse me, the consent item, sorry.
The evidence, and your Honor, the district court does not use the word direct, but this court's opinion in Tuma versus Crochel, which I think is clearly the most apposite precedent in this case, clearly and specifically distinguishes between direct evidence, which would be basically an admission, and circumstantial evidence. That's where I derive those terms from. So with respect to your question on the consent agenda of the council, there was a lot of circumstantial evidence my clients submitted, including at least four affidavits, two from residents who were not parties to the case, observers of the city council, longtime observers, who said they repeatedly observed behavior that suggested decisions had been made before meetings. I think the most compelling circumstantial evidence my clients submitted, though, Your Honor, was an affidavit, a long affidavit by plaintiff Lauren Cederstrom, who gave the court 15 links to public access Facebook audio and video of council meetings, showing 15 separate occasions on which the council members had discussed matters, had put matters on the consent agenda that they clearly seemed to have discussed and decided before the meeting. Now, that's not clear, unequivocal, decisive proof, but if you combine it with the fact that my clients had been themselves members of the city council for 3 years at the time this complaint was drafted, it requires a bit of credulity to say that they didn't have the capacity observing meeting after meeting after meeting of this behavior and conclude that there was something amiss.
So with respect to, were there any, I mean, consent items are generally unremarkable items that generally pass without much controversy. Were there specific consent items that they pointed to, or is it just? I guess I wasn't sure. Like, what are the? Were there particular things that appeared and particular comments or evidence that showed that those particular things were talked about? I'm trying to find out, like, what is the basis in fact? Because that's what we're getting down to. Was there a good factual basis for bringing, or a non-frivolous basis for bringing these claims? And I didn't quite follow, besides sort of general statements about, well, it seems like they, I don't know, if they agree to them, they already must have discussed them. But by their nature, they're consent items are usually generally agreed to. That's what I couldn't quite figure out, how that's evidence, even circumstantial, of a open meeting law violation.
Right, Your Honor. Two things. First, there were at least three or four affidavits, from two from residents and two from my clients as council members, who said over 3 years, many, many, many times, they observed behavior by the majority of the council that clearly suggested they had pre-decided an issue. It wasn't just...
Did they describe that behavior at all? Is the behavior, in other words, agreeing with the consent item? That's what I couldn't quite figure out, which wouldn't really tell us very much, as you know.
No, it wouldn't. But the thing about a consent agenda is that it's sort of self-defining. If it's supposed to be relatively minor, inconsequential, non-controversial items, but if controversial, significant, substantive items repeatedly show up on the consent agenda and require no discussion to be approved, that suggests something has been pre-decided. It's not direct proof, but it's suggestive. And
right.
That's,
so were those things shown? Was there evidence that there were controversial items that appeared on the consent agenda? And were those things identified?
Mr. Cederstrom's affidavit, where he actually embedded links to actual meetings where you could observe the discussion, does exactly that. That was its function, to do that. Now, the problem was that Judge McBride completely ignored that evidence. He didn't just say that he didn't believe it, that it wasn't persuasive, that it wasn't sufficient, but he completely ignored it. He held explicitly that only direct evidence counted in his analysis, that circumstantial evidence had no room at the table. And that's the big problem with his ruling, because this court has repeatedly made clear that, as recently as this Areola decision last year, that circumstantial evidence is entitled to every bit as much weight in proving facts in a civil action as is direct evidence. The court says that specifically. Even more compellingly is this court's decision in Tuma versus Crochel, which I, of course, cite at length in my briefs, in which, in another open meeting law case, this court says specifically that requiring the presentation of direct evidence would place an intolerable burden on a plaintiff alleging an open meeting law violation, where typically such discussions take place in secret. And the court there sustained a trial court's judgment against a public officials based purely on circumstantial evidence. So
well, can you counsel then help me by giving me the best example of a controversial item that appeared on a consent agenda that showed that these defendants, by inference, pre-discussed it and violated the open meeting law? Like, what's the best evidence that was put in that these defendants, as part of this claim, violated the open meeting law? By inference, because it was a controversial agenda item. I'm just trying to understand. I understand there's an affidavit that sends us to links and stuff, but I'm just trying to figure out if you can just help me. Links to what? What is the idea? What is the agenda item?
The idea is that several significant and substantive, potentially controversial issues were approved on a consent agenda without discussion. Now, I do not.
Can you name one or not?
I can't. Not as I sit here. There were scores and scores over 3 years. The other disadvantage I have, Your Honor, and I apologize, is I was not trial counsel. I did not represent these clients at the trial court level. If I had, I'm sure I could answer that question more effectively, but I can't. But it's in the record. It's clearly supported circumstantially. Was it enough to survive a summary judgment motion? I think that's a reasonable debate. I think.
Sure, Infants, then could I ask you the judge's order, then the sanction judge? Now we're talking about. And I'm reading from page 3 of 4 in the memo to the order. The court finds that plaintiff's claims, history, and discovery practices demonstrate that an award of attorney's fees and costs is appropriate. I'm assuming claims is in reference to the issues you're right now talking about and the underlying basis for the allegations and the reason for the summary judgment. My question to you is, what was the judge referring to in history and discovery practices, and where in the record would we find the answer to those phrases?
Your Honor, that's a very good question, because Judge Peaton doesn't answer that either in her order. She makes those two references to claims. Claims, I think, are clearly the claims my clients made. But the history and discovery practices, she doesn't explain. However, it's pretty clear if you look at the respondents' submissions in support of their motion for sanctions to Judge Peaton, they claim that my client engaged in improper discovery practices and had a long history of litigation with local public officials, although they were public officials too. The problem with both of those elements of her order is that the discovery, there's nothing suggesting my clients did anything improper in discovery. They engaged in discovery as allowed by the scheduling order and the rules. The respondent's claim here, and Mr. Reavers will I'm sure address this, was based more on the fact that the respondent's attorney supposedly warned my clients not to engage in any more discovery because their claims were frivolous, and my clients didn't accept that characterization of their claims and felt that they should continue with discovery. And the issue of other claims history or litigation, I don't know how that's even relevant to this case. I think to answer your question, if the claims that my client made are indeed frivolous and without merit, I don't think those other two elements make much difference. But if they're not, if the claims aren't frivolous, and I don't see how they can be, then the whole order is tainted by the reference to the claims, regardless of what else it might be based on.
Thank you, Mr. Anfinson. We have finished the initial 15 minutes allotted to the appellant, and with that, we'll turn to respondent. So, counsel for respondent, you can begin with your remarks when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Paul Reavers, and I represent the respondents in this matter. And we are asking the court to affirm the district court's determination in its entirety. The trial court did not abuse its discretion when it determined this action was frivolous and malicious. And I've handled a number of open meeting law claims over my career. I've never seen a more direct claim by a district court than this one. And I ask you to affirm this because the court had a factual basis for that. And the court's analysis needs to start, obviously, with Minnesota Statute 13D06, Subdivision 4B. And that term's about if the court finds the action under this chapter was frivolous and without merit, the trial court has the discretion to award fees. And there was a sufficient basis for that finding. And I want to go to, a couple things I want to point to the court in the record. Number one, I think it's important to start with the allegations and the complaint that were made. My colleague, Mr. Anfinson, when he filed his initial brief, solely relied on the pleadings and cited nothing in the record. And I think you should start with the complaint, and I think it's important to look at paragraphs 4 and 18, what he accused the city council, the majority of the city council, of perpetuating in this matter. Paragraph 4, all matters concerning city business are discussed and decided in secret. Paragraph 18, the city council majority routinely violates the public meeting law at almost every public meeting. That's outrageous allegations without any factual support. Let me get to this consent agenda item, because there is a record here, and the record undercuts the arguments that Mr. Anfinson has made in this case. Now, let me start with this video clip. So I think Mr. Anfinson indicated his best evidence was the affidavit of Lauren Cedarstrom, the plaintiff. Court will find that at document entry number 32. It's really a short affidavit, and nowhere in that affidavit does he allege any of those video clips suggest there's anything nefarious going on. Now, if you look at these, there's 15 clips. Now, half of these are outside the two-year statute of limitations. It is frivolous. There is no basis in fact or law to suggest meetings that occurred 2 years before the statute of limitations expired or after, that those claims that are not actionable somehow are evidence of open meeting law violations. 7 we can just cross off. The other 8, there's no transcript in the record. We actually looked at them. And I'm going to point the court, there's actually in the record, there's actually of those remaining 8 clips, there are 3 consent agendas that are in the record. And I want to cite the court to the record. It's a document number 21. It's the affidavit of the city administrative clerk. And the meetings are June 29, 2017, December 5, 2017, and February 6, 2018. These are exhibits 27, 35, and 36. I invite the court to look at those. There is nothing in there. I'll look at the, I pulled all these again out of the record. We're looking at minutes, the bill list, road work, and the fire contracts. I frankly challenge my colleague to point to anything in the record that any of the consent agendas suggest there's anything wrong or non. And there's also, I want to point the court to the other consent agenda items, because we thought it was important, if they're going to throw that kind of mud, that it was important for us to show how the city operates. And again, Ms. Point's affidavit, again, this is document number 21. I think it's a critical one to show how the city does business. But exhibits 8, 12, 15, 16, and 34 are a number of other meetings where we show it's the minutes, it's the norm of bills, it's the fire contract, it's the police contract. There's nothing there. I mean, I truly invite the court to look there. And it's frankly, it's not the court's job to dig through the record. It's the appellant's burden to point the court in the record where they find the support for it. It's not
a- Mr. Evers, can I inquire? Mr. Oh, Evers, when I look at the judge's order and I quoted the language that seemed to be the closest to what I would describe as a finding by the court, but I don't see any reference in the findings to even the points you're making right now. Would not the sanctioning court be required, since it was especially a different judge than who granted summary judgment, explore the record and then identify some of the same things you're referring to come to a conclusion that the matter's frivolous? And then my second question is, the statute refers to an action. So if we were to separate the consent agenda allegation from the planning commission allegation, do you see different levels of allegations there that required facts for or consideration at summary judgment before dismissed when considering whether it's frivolous?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to your first question, we pointed all this out to the district court when we argued this case. And I think Judge McBride's point was, tell me where, when, how this happened, because there's nothing in the record.
But how do we know Judge Peeton, what points of what you allege versus what was responded that Judge Peeton found to be frivolous?
Well, the plaintiff's counsel or appellant's counsel at the record challenged that determination, and we submitted all of the evidence there. So they asked the court to review the area, review that finding, and she made the specific determination that that finding made by Justice McBride, or Judge McBride, was not clearly erroneous. I think it's the last sentence of her order indicates here plaintiffs have failed to establish the court's finding was clearly erroneous. So she had the full record in front of her. She had the benefit of plaintiff's counsel arguing where did they miss it, and they didn't do it. So that's the sufficient finding. I mean, frankly, you look just here, what I pointed out to the court is, does the record support that finding? And I suggest the record does suggest the finding. And I think you need to look at this as an action. Because this all spilled all together, I think. I think, frankly, the court looked at the Planning Commission. And the other part I want to comment on the Planning Commission is the affidavit of John Rogg. This is a document 22, because this is a meeting that ends. And the plaintiff, Mr. Lanoux, he's having a 10 to 15 minute discussion with the chair, John Rogg, and that's his affidavit laying that out. And there's no allegation there's anything wrong or nefarious or, you know, there's improper discussions. Plaintiff is there for almost the whole time, then walks out and then decides, I got him, walks back and takes a picture. I think it's appropriate for the district court to say, I'm looking at how thin and malicious this open meeting law claim is. You've got the same issue here. We have no evidence. There's no circumstantial evidence here. There's nothing controversial. There's no allegation in the record that the Planning Commission made a secret decision. There's no allegation that anything happened at that Planning Commission was controversial.
Mr. Rovers, did I understand from the record correctly, however, that he did allege that he saw on the computer screen the subdivision, I can't remember the specific identification of the property that apparently previously had been discussed, and he alleged that he saw them viewing that on the computer screen. The question I have is, that seems to be the reference to the circumstantial evidence that the Thuma case clearly said would be an alternative or a sufficient method. And I'm not really discussing the merits, we aren't, of the summary judgment. So I understand the difference in that case is later the mayor apparently confirmed what was talked about, or at least implied. We don't have that here, and I assume your client submitted affidavits to confirm that they were having small talk, but that required a summary judgment. I guess my question is, how does that rise to the level of frivolous, and what definition are you using, or you believe we should use, to define frivolous?
Well, when I look at frivolous, I do think it's plain meaning. I think it's no good faith basis in fact or law. I mean, that's how I've always looked at it. You have no good faith basis for the claims you're making. And they don't here when you look at the totality of the record in front of the district. There's nothing, and again, we've got the affidavits of the city planner who's there saying, I was having trouble with what was going on. And the plaintiff was there for 15 minutes, which is different here. I think that Thuma case, significance here, in the middle of the meeting, they go out and they're clearly looking at the contract and they go back and talk about it, and the chair slips up. Oh, we decided. I mean, it truly is a different matter here, whereas there's nothing controversial going on here. There needs to be more than simply, I snapped a picture and that's enough to sue folks that are volunteers on the Planning Commission for an open meeting law violation.
I'm sorry, Judge Bradfield. Can I ask, is the record, is it in the record as undisputed evidence that Mr. Lanoux, right, was present in the conversation with a quorum while that same slide was up? Okay, is that there? And then he leaves and then snaps a picture, is that right?
Correct. And I pulled that, and we submitted his deposition transcript, and this is a document 20. I think it's my colleague Stephanie Engelkar's affidavit, but it's document 20. It's the deposition of Mr. Lanoux, and the operative pages of his deposition where he talks about this are pages 22 through like 40. But he says he was talking, he went up to John Rogg, congratulated him for being chair, then handed him some materials and talked to him for a period of time. So that's undisputed. And it's also undisputed, he testified, he doesn't recall how long he talked to Mr. Rogg, but we have Mr. Rogg's affidavit saying it was 10 to 15 minutes, and that's document 22. So I invite document 20 and 22, he's talking to him there. And again, it'd be one thing if...
Right. I'm wondering about the slide that was up on a projection. If it was up there, if it's of the record, whether in the record, whether that was displayed while Mr. Lanoux was present.
When he came and snapped a picture, I know the picture of folks standing around the table is in the record. I can't tell you as I sit here exactly what it shows, but you can see the people around the table. Mr. Lanoux was there too. Again, it'd be a different situation if Mr. Lanoux says, oh boy, they really were talking about things, and I felt really uncomfortable, and I walked out, or you know, they were, we don't have anything like that at all. And if he truly was concerned about good government, what you do is, especially when you got a guy who's his first day on the planning commission, you know, Mr. Helander, one of the defendants, first day in the planning commission, you get sued for an open meeting law violation. If you really were concerned about good government, you would say, hey guys, maybe you shouldn't be here because somebody could, you know, allege that you're violating the open meeting law. We ought to encourage people to have a collegial nature. I mean, under their theory, people who show up early for a meeting, which most people do, and they're milling around, could be subject to an open meeting law case if staff is fiddling around with the PowerPoint to make sure it works, to say, aha, that's enough to sue people under an open meeting law violation. And on this record, we don't have that. And I think that's a critical difference. When you look at this action as a whole, it's contrived. It truly is malicious. Especially
Counsel, can you answer the question about the when the court said it finds that the plaintiff's claims history and discovery practices demonstrate that an award of attorney fees and costs is appropriate? What about history and discovery practices would be relevant to the determination of whether the claims are frivolous and malicious?
Well, I think the litigation practices, the point that we were making, and I think the court was, we made is, listen, we warned you four times, and if you're going to run through depositions and run the cost up, and that's what that point is. I don't think that alone is the basis for it. I think that goes to the amount of the awards, and that's at least that's how we presented. I mean, I can't get in the judge's head, so to speak, but how we presented it to the court was, we gave them four safe harbors, so to speak, of, listen, here's four opportunities to withdraw. So,
counsel, just if I can ask a slightly more pointed question, I don't hear you saying that the judge found that the history, plaintiff's history and plaintiff's discovery practices are frivolous or not in good faith, but maybe I'm misunderstanding. You seem to be saying that they were warned that if they continue to pursue discovery, obviously that would increase the attorney's fee claim that could be made.
I think that the part on the history, so on the discovery practices, no, I would agree that that's not a basis for the finding goes to the amount. On the history, a little different in the record, and if I may, I see my time's about up, if I can finish this.
You can answer the question, go ahead.
I think there's two important points, and this is laid out in our brief, but number one, Mr. Cederstrom was sanctioned under Rule 11. For bringing a similar type secret meeting claim. So I do think that goes to a deterrent effect. When we look at the reason for sanctions, the reason the legislature put that provision in there was that they were certainly concerned that folks could weaponize the open meeting law. And so I do think that goes to, I mean, Frank, goes to the amount, the severity of the sanction.
So counsel, I take it you are summarizing the arguments that you made in support of sanctions. Absolutely. And the evidence you offered. And I guess my question was a little narrower. It was looking at the district court's reasons for awarding sanctions. The judge certainly references history, but doesn't say what you just said.
That's how we presented it to the court. I think that goes to the deterrent effect of the past practices, but certainly the amount. I mean, when we look at deterrent effect, and that's how we presented was, the reason you have sanctions is to deter this type of conduct. That's why we thought it was important to alert the court to those types of things, so we weren't here again. But with that, I will respectfully ask that the court affirm the trial court's determination and award us all of the costs and fees. There's no challenge that our fees weren't reasonable or directly tied to the claims in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll reset the clock for 5 minutes for rebuttal. Appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. I will be brief. Just a couple follow-up points on this. First of all, on the consent agenda issue, I have never debated the fact that the evidence my clients presented was not conclusive and may not have been sufficient to survive summary judgment. That's a debatable question. But they observed the majority's behavior for almost 3 years as fellow council members, and they submitted affidavits detailing what they observed. And people can notice when decisions appear to be pre-decided if you're an experienced public official. So to say that it was frivolous for them to claim that many of these important decisions appear to have been pre-decided is nonsensical. It's circumstantial, but it's not it's still evidence of what they observed with their own presence in the council meetings. We do point to examples of that, and that goes to the weight of the evidence. It's not, it still was a good faith effort to show that a violation had occurred. Now, on the Planning Commission issue, Mr. Reavers makes much of points that are not relevant to the issue before the court. He says there was nothing controversial about this Planning Commission meeting. That isn't the standard of the open meeting law. What the open meeting law prohibits is discussing public business outside of a public meeting. And that's what my client alleged happened. The fact that these people are volunteers, the fact that it may have been one of the members' first meetings, again, that has no bearing on this. Yes, Mr. Lanoux may have been talking to some of the members for a while, but not the entire time. In the Tuma case, the Planning Commission only was out of the meeting room for 8 minutes. That was sufficient to trigger an open meeting law violation inferentially. There was never direct evidence of a violation. And the whole core of this court's decision in Tuma is that circumstantial evidence was sufficient to prove a violation based on the circumstances. That the parallels here between Tuma and the Planning Commission element of my client's claim are very close. They're not identical. No two cases are ever exactly the same, but they're very close. And the attorney who represented my clients in the district court framed her complaint, that portion of her complaint, following the guidance of Tuma.
I understand you're not even arguing a summary judgment issue, but I mean, if Mr. Lanoux had been out to dinner with the group, which they can socialize, of course, without it being an open meeting law, and sees no open meeting law violation, then leaves and snaps a picture of him and says, we can have circumstantial evidence that they're having a open meeting law, but the difference here is what's on the screen, right? And yes, that the fact that there's something on the screen. And that's why I was wondering, well, if the screen was up the whole time with this, or if he'd, what's the difference between that and just leaving dinner with them when there was a perfectly fine conversation and turning around and snapping a photo? You know what I'm saying?
But Your Honor, that's not what he did. That's Mr. Reavers' version of what he did. That's not what he alleges. That's not what happened. He walked away. He did talk to them for a while. He walked away, and then he looked back and he observed for a few minutes, and the Planning Commission quorum stood there and continued to talk to each other and looked at the materials on the screen. This wasn't simply, 10 seconds and he turns around and takes a picture. And that's the problem.
So he averred that they looked at, that they were looking at the screen, the members.
His photograph shows them looking at the screen and talking to each other. And that's the core of this issue. Yes, is that evidence sufficient to prove a violation? We can debate that, but that's not the issue on appeal. The core of this appeal remains very straightforward. The trial court completely and categorically rejected the relevance of any circumstantial evidence of any kind. It required proof by my clients that the members had actually talked to each other secretly about public business, which, as this court in Tuma said, is virtually impossible to acquire. So the question is whether, either legally or factually, their claims were frivolous. And on the record, they were absolutely not, based on Tuma. There was simply circumstantial evidence of some weight and relevance suggesting that they did violate the open meeting law. And by rejecting circumstantial evidence, that fatally tainted the district court's ruling, especially since it didn't explain itself at all and didn't even mention the circumstantial evidence.
So it sounds like, counsel, you've completed your remarks for rebuttal, and we thank you very much. Thanks as well to respondents, counsel. This matter is now submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.